Hello and welcome to the Kojit podcast series. Kojit is, as a reminder, a project to do with covering and discussing contemporary issues in terrorism and counterterrorism. My name is Anthony Richards and I'm the editorial director of Kojit. Today I'm very pleased to be joined by Dr. Sarah Marsden, who is a senior lecturer at the Hander Centre for the Study of Terrorism and Political Violence at the University of St. Andrews. She is the author of Reintegrating Extremists, De-Radicalization and Desistance, which was published with Palgrave in 2017. And she's currently leading research projects for the Center for Research and Evidence on Security Threats, CREST for short, and in particular on two projects for CREST entitled Constraining Violence, and secondly, Trauma, Adversity and Violent Extremism. Sarah, welcome and thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks, Anthony. It's a pleasure to be here.
Could I start, perhaps, in relation to your Constraining Violence project and what protects against terrorism and against involvement in violent extremism? I wonder if you could share with us some of the examples that you're drawing upon within that project and more broadly, perhaps, what your thoughts are on how to reduce the risk of terrorism.
Thanks, Anthony. Yeah, this is a really great project. I'm delighted to be part of it. It really asks the question about why terrorism doesn't happen. So the provocation is really, why is it that despite the number of people who engage in violent extremist subcultures, so for example, online, so very few go on to actually break the law or engage in violence or terrorism? So what we're doing is looking at constraints in a couple of different ways. So first of all, at the individual level, we're looking at research and trying to develop a better understanding about protective factors. So these are the things which mitigate or buffer the effects of the risk factors that we are beginning to understand better in relation to increasing risk of radicalization or involvement in violence. But also we're looking at the kind of organizational, the meso level, and we're following researchers like Gilbert Ramsey and Joel Busher, who've begun to ask whether there are actually organizational or sort of subcultural features that might help explain the limits on violence. And it's fair to say neither of those areas have received a lot of attention. So our research really wants to develop a way of thinking about what constrains violence and theorizing how protective factors might work. So I'm working particularly with my colleague Ben Lee, who's an expert on the contemporary extreme right. So that's the subcultural space that we're interested in. And of course, that's very diverse too. So at the moment, Ben's analysing right-wing subcultures to really explore a couple of ideas we've got about how constraints might work. We're about halfway through the research programme, so I can't give you any kind of final conclusions. But I think what's interesting is the way that we've tried to think about those subcultural constraints and the way they might work. So first of all, what we want to try and understand is whether those sorts of subcultural spaces provide opportunities for people to find meaning, enjoyment, fulfillment, without moving towards violence. So those might be really intrinsically rewarding for people, but they don't necessarily require people to become involved in violence, even though those subcultures are predicated on violence. So really, to oversimplify, if somebody's heavily motivated by a strong need to belong, they might find that they're able to meet that need without the need to engage in any kind of illegal activities. So that's the first idea we're exploring. The second one is the idea that there might be patterns of subcultural capital which develop in extremist spaces in ways which prioritize certain forms of non-violent or legal action. And that might actually, we think, complicate the move towards violence. So for example, certain subcultures might emphasize values like resilience or patience or the need to wait until the time's right to act. And they might actually constrain the potential for violence. So we're really trying to understand better what might be at work within those spaces to try and understand what might constrain them. And then the other side is the individual level. So that protective factor question. And again, relatively little attention has been paid to it. So what we're trying to do, first of all, is map the research. So we've produced again with Ben a map of protective factors that look at a range of different things which seem to protect or mitigate against violence. So this might be individual level factors like coping skills or empathy, social factors like supportive family contexts, as well as attitudes like trust in authority, and then sort of wider contextual factors like social integration. So what we're trying to do now is not just describe them, but try and explain them. So why is it that these protective factors seem to be effective, and when do they fail. So what happens when they fall away? So we're trying to understand and develop a model, really, of how protective factors function. And in that way, obviously feed into efforts to try and help people. Because the approach we're basically taking is drawn from criminological theory. And it's this idea of stepping away from that heavily risk-oriented approach. So thinking less about risk and more about sort of strengths and skills that people can develop. And the idea is that if you can develop those skills and strengths, if you can help people overcome barriers to achieving things that matter to them, then you're more likely to help them move away from violent extremism and to sort of achieve the things they want without the need to engage in violence. So that's what we've been doing so far. A lot of sort of mapping of the research base, a lot of thinking about what protective factors are and how they might work, as well as trying to think, as I say, at that subcultural level about what might be going on within those spaces to help us explain why we don't see as much violence as we might perhaps anticipate, given the very violent, saturated nature of those extremist spaces.
How challenging is it, therefore, to build a model per se, when I think you've made reference to all sorts of different factors that might be involved?
Yeah, that's actually one of the challenges, because when, again, when you think about that sort of full range of risk and protective factors that we tend to see in the literature, it can be really difficult to know, well, which of these matter, which are more or less important in individual cases. So the model is aimed to be as elegant as possible, in the sense that it tries to really consolidate and ask a series of quite straightforward questions. So it starts with this idea that, again, it draws on criminological theory. So it draws on particularly a theory called the Good Lives Model. And this assumes that people try and achieve certain kinds of goods. It might be around community. It could be about spirituality. It could be about health. And sometimes they're blocked in achieving those goods. And when they're blocked, they might see crime or harmful behaviour as a route to achieving those goods. So there are 11 of these goods altogether, and it's been starting to filter into practice and be reflected more in work with terrorism offenders, but also more generally, it was developed for work with sex offenders. And so the idea is basically individuals want to achieve certain goals. There are certain kinds of barriers which get in the way, and protective factors are those things which help people overcome those barriers or give them better chances to achieve them. So on the one hand, it is quite complex because there's a lot of factors at play, but then, of course, life's complex. So we don't want to kind of oversimplify too much, but then equally, we want to try and consolidate that in a model which helps practitioners and researchers think about how protective factors might work. Because one of the challenges in this space is that there's a lot of description and less explanation. So there's less emphasis on that broader kind of motivational interpretation of why people act as they do. And that good lives based approach, that strengths based approach, gives us a much broader framework. So really, there are two bits of theory we're pulling from other disciplines, criminology, and of course, sociology in relation to subcultural processes too. So we're magpies, we're drawing on research and evidence and theory from other spaces which have tackled similar questions to help us in the violent extremist space.
If I can turn now to your other CREST project, you've made the argument that research should pay more attention to the role of trauma and adversity in relation to terrorism. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit more about that work and why you think trauma in particular is so relevant to terrorism studies.
We've been running this program for about 18 months now, and I'm working with my colleague James Lewis and other colleagues at St Andrews on it. And really what we're trying to do, as you say, is understand better how trauma and adversity is relevant to violent extremism, how it shapes pathways into terrorism, and of course to identify the implications for interventions and efforts to support people, either stopping them, interrupting them getting involved, or helping them move away. So again, we've been mapping the research, we're doing a systematic review at the moment, but we think trauma matters for a few reasons. The first is that really a very large proportion of those who become involved in terrorism have experienced some form of trauma. In actual fact, many of us have. There's international research which suggests perhaps 70% of us have experienced a traumatic event, but we are extending the notion of trauma beyond just that sort of stereotypical understanding of a, you know, highly significant personal event, to instead take a broader view of what counts as trauma, thinking about adversity. So also in relation to, for instance, adverse childhood experiences, which are those negative formative experiences like physical abuse or emotional neglect, which can have really long-term developmental and psychosocial effects. So we're first of all trying to broaden out that notion of what trauma and adversity means. And second of all, thinking about what that means for us when we're trying to explain involvement in extremism, because that sort of framework, that trauma-informed framework, starts from a slightly different place. because instead of asking kind of what's wrong with you, what are the risks that you hold, it asks what happened to you and how did you cope. So this draws attention to some of the factors that might shape those more concrete risk factors, but it also offers a way of thinking about motivation and contextual factors that are relevant to understanding engagement. So instead of looking at sort of a mental health issue, this approach asks, well, how did that individual come to have that mental health problem? So it enables us to broaden out and to position somebody's involvement in extremism in their life, in their wider life cycle, and also think about how, you know, the relationship between trauma and violent extremism might be mediated. What's really important is that we don't see these as causal processes. It's not as though obviously somebody experiences a traumatic event and that, you know, it moves them towards violent extremism. And that's one of the other things we're trying to understand, these really complex processes whereby, you know, a traumatic event can sometimes, so Pete Simeon and Steve Windisch have talked about this cycle of adversity or this sort of downward spiral. So you might find yourself in a really challenging situation at home. You don't want to be in the home environment, so you're on the streets. And in the street context, you might encounter lots of different kinds of risks. And some of those risks might be oriented towards political violence or violent extremism. And of course, this is the interesting question. Those violent extremist spaces, those subcultures, those networks, if you like, or those groups can actually seem to be really attractive and actually might perform a protective function because they address some of those issues. If you don't have social support outside of, you know, in your normal life, you might find them within those extremist spaces. And, you know, Daniel Kuhl has also argued that actually some of those recruiters try and mobilize trauma. They tell people why they're traumatized and then they say, and this is the solution. So there's some really complex processes at work that we think are really important to understand better, so that we can understand when and why trauma and adversity matters in relation to those pathways into and out of extremism. So we're really excited to kind of pursue that and to develop a better conceptualization of it, but also do some empirical research around that as well.
I was just thinking about the conceptual side of it, actually. I'm sure you've had lots of deliberations on obviously what the parameters of what you mean by trauma and adversity are. But I mean, notwithstanding those definitional debates or discussions, perhaps, I'm just wondering, in terms of the prevalence of trauma and adversity and any, not causal, but correlation between violent extremism, do you find that's different to perhaps any sort of comparison with the population as a whole? Is there a different correlation, or is it just actually the same as perhaps nationally?
It's a really good question, and we don't have those kinds of easily comparable prevalence rates. So we don't have, in much more generally, of course, as you'll know, within the wider field, we don't have base rates necessarily that allow us to measure certain kinds of attitudes or experiences in the broader population against what might be happening in the violent extremist space. That we are beginning to develop some of those. So Paul Gill and his team have been developing a better understanding of what those base rates might be. But it's difficult to really kind of compare how many people might have experienced a deeply traumatic event and have subsequently gone on to be involved in violent extremism versus the wider population. So what we're trying to do is sort of unpick some of those dynamics a little bit more, just to start prizing open the black box, really, and understand some of those processes a bit better. Because I think, you know, what's really key is that experiences of trauma and adversity can be relevant to a whole range of different kind of risk factors. So it's not just, you know, kind of one risk factor in relation to trauma, you know, impacts this sort of outcome. It's more about the interactions. So for instance, we've been fortunate to engage with Heidi Ellis and her colleagues in America, who've been working for quite a long time in this space. And they argue that trauma can be mediated by trust in authority. So if you experience a really traumatic event, it can impact how you, the degree to which you trust the authorities and the legal apparatus, and that can therefore influence the way that you might respond to whether it's recruiters or sort of violent extremist overtures, if you like. So there's a really complex set of mechanisms at work that we want to try and understand better.
If I can slightly change tack, a couple of years ago, Sarah, you wrote that media giants such as Facebook, Google, Twitter, and so on, and I quote, are being asked to identify and remove extremist online content, a process which implies the ability to identify and designate particular kinds of material as terroristic. And that sentence really struck me because I think the implied ability to identify and designate particular types of online material as terroristic or not, it touches on a really important question. Because, and I ask this because, for example, in the 2018 contest strategy, we hear of terrorist material online, we hear of the need to tackle it, but very little in the way of definition of what that means and what the parameters are of that. And I suppose it's a tough question, but how difficult is it to draw any line between what is and isn't terroristic online?
It is a really tricky question. And it really goes to the heart of how the law, how society, and as part of that, how technology companies define terrorism. And I don't need to talk to you about how hard that is, given your work in that area. So it's just incredibly difficult because, not least, the online space is obviously international. It crosses borders. So it can't be as easily governed by certain sorts of legislative frameworks. And so instead of that, it's typically reliant on commercial organisations. And they make decisions, often with input from others and so on, about what should be banned or what constitutes violent extremist content. But of course, that inevitably bumps up against the question of freedom of speech. And depending on the country context, that's got the potential to open the way to censorship of political and popular views. It also might sort of incentivize those tech companies to over-censor. So let's say you've got a particular country context they want to keep working in, and so they will include very strict set terms of service to try and ensure that they don't fall foul of that national legislation. Others have argued that when liberal democracies ban content or try and identify certain kinds of content, then it paves the way for authoritarian states to follow suit. So it's incredibly difficult at a kind of normative level, because to argue, this should happen is going to produce so many unintended consequences. And because the sort of heart of it is so subjective in many ways, it makes it incredibly difficult to set out a framework for how you manage that challenge. The practicalities of it are really hard too. So content moderation is really fraught with difficulties. Online platforms, whatever platform it is, have so much material there that they often use automatic processes to flag material. But of course, they're not entirely neutral. They can be biased. So some people have argued that they're less able to pick up right-wing material, for instance, or they're less able to take account of gender differences in the way that people communicate. So it means that those automated processes might have bias built in. They are obviously going to be limited by what's possible. And then you've got this broader kind of social and normative question about what do we think is appropriate to make available to people? And what kinds of mechanisms do state actors have to censor or to limit what people should be engaging with? And there just aren't easy answers about where to draw the line and what people should and shouldn't be able to say and do online. So an incredibly difficult question, which I think is just going to continue, because again, you've got a whole other set of unintended consequences that if you take material down from, mainstream or surface web platforms, the chances of people moving to less easily regulated and whether that's the dark web or other spaces where it's easier for people to communicate without any kind of censorship, that can create additional risks and challenges. So there are so many complexities around this debate. It's incredibly difficult. And I think it's a part of a broader social conversation about where do we draw the line and what's appropriate to try and inhibit people's capacity to interact with material which we might find offensive or dangerous.
Yeah, absolutely. And even when we're not in the online world, of course, in the real world, there's this sort of big debate as the extent that we should be concerned with not so-called non-violent extremism. That in 2011 Prevent strategy was said to be conducive to terrorism, or whether we should be just be concerned with what people do, or whether we should be more concerned with the way people think as well. Of course, that, if you transfer that into the online world, of course, that has all kinds of implications as what you think is worthy of attention online, I guess. Going back to your book, Reintegrating Extremists, and you argued that actually reintegration is a more appropriate framework or model than de-radicalization. I wonder if you could elaborate further on that.
De-radicalization typically is understood as sort of focusing very much on the individual level. So trying to try and change somebody's attitudes, their ideas, their opinions, and so on. Now, in some cases, those things might be really, really helpful. And it might be really relevant to somebody's sort of progress or movement away from violent extremism that those issues are addressed. But that focus on the individual level and their attitudes and opinions, it does also bump up against sort of freedom of speech or freedom of thought, at least, and the extent to which we are and should be able to hold offensive views, if you like. But as well as that, they also neglect the wider kind of social and ecological context somebody lives in. So the importance of social connections, pro-social networks, a wider community that somebody belongs to, as well as things not just around social reintegration, but also economic reintegration. So, for example, employment, education, practical things through which people can move forward. And alongside that, political reintegration. So that might be around things like voting or accepting the legitimacy of authorities. Those processes are really important to supporting somebody's reintegration, somebody's sort of progress and movement away from violent extremism. They're almost always relational. They're better understood and supported by taking account of someone's wider social context. You know, the wider literature tells us that norms and peer attitudes are really important influences on us. If our friends and our family believe something, then we are more likely to believe it too. So trying to just change the individual's attitudes and then, you know, sort of placing them in a context that might be, you know, after they've been in prison, or it might be when they're moving away from a violent extremist group where they don't have any kind of social reference points which support them, is, it's not quite doomed to fail, that's not fair, but it is certainly less likely to be able to leverage the benefits of that wider social context. So it seems to me that starting with that effort to try and enable reintegration on a really practical level, social level, economically, politically, rather than sort of starting with this idea of changing somebody's ideas, is better able to support the process of desistance. And I think it's fair to say, actually, since the book was published, the evidence base is tending to support that idea. So although obviously we don't have a huge amount of research which talks in concrete and very empirically robust terms about what works in relation to reintegration or desistance or de-radicalisation even, the evidence that we do have is starting to point towards that idea that broader social reintegration programmes might be better able to support positive change compared with those narrow de-radicalised interventions. So not least because they're more motivating to people. Because if you're sort of engaging with somebody and you're trying to work with them and help them, and your effort is to try and change their mind about something, you can imagine the kind of resistance that that might attract, particularly when the individual concerned might, you know, reject the state or reject the starting points for that process. Whereas if you start with a process of saying, how can we help you connect with your family? What kind of social networks do you want to be part of? What kind of work do you want to do? And of course, these are all parts of intervention programs. They're all part of case management programs, but they tend to be neglected a little bit in this space compared to this effort to think about the role of ideology or the role of attitudes and opinions. And it seems to me that focusing more on trying to support that reintegration process is more likely to be appealing to the individual and, in the long term, more likely to sustain that sort of desistance over time. So the argument for that sort of broader social reintegration approach doesn't necessarily discount the relevance of working with and through somebody's ideas, but it changes the priorities and focuses much more on supporting reintegration rather than addressing perceived to be negative ideas or attitudes.
Dr. Sarah Marsden, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts and your important research with us. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you very much for joining us today. Thank you to all our listeners who are listening, and goodbye to you all.